podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. This is a football-free zone, just for a few minutes. I know that everybody's attention is on both Wales and England, and of course other countries, all playing at the moment. But we're going to be talking cricket today, of course, because England are about to go to Pakistan for their three-match test series starting on December the 1st. And we're going to hear in this podcast from a man who helped England win in Pakistan a long time ago now, 20 years ago, Duncan Fletcher. We're going to hear from him. We're also going to hear from a man who's going to be there in about 3 days' time, Simon Mann. You're heading to Pakistan. Are you looking forward to it?
I am, yeah, really looking forward to it. Off on Sunday, so we arrive Monday morning. We're staying in Rawalpindi or Islamabad, which is right next to Rawalpindi, in the same hotel as the players. We don't have the same security detail the players are going to have. Pakistan and England teams in the same hotel. Then we don't stay in the same hotel as them in Multan. We get to Multan on the roads, minibuses, 6-hour car journey, and then we fly on to Karachi for the final test match, and we meet up with the players and both teams again in the same hotel. It'll be interesting to see what the security is like, what the restrictions are like, what travel to the ground is like and travel back again, and what the security is like around the ground. But let's hope everything goes off really well, as it did for the T20 series, and that it's a really fascinating test series. Can't wait.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I'm sure it's great, actually, isn't it, that England are going back after 16 years of the last time they were in Pakistan for a test series. And it's great for the Pakistanis, of course, as well, that they've got live test cricket to watch, especially after that brilliant series against Australia a while back, which was very hard fought and the Australians won in the end, but lots of excellent cricket. So tremendous in prospect. Now, the man who helped England win last time in Pakistan, as I mentioned, Duncan Fletcher, was our guest in the Virtual Cricket Club the other night. And he, of course, engineered England's victory in 2001. They won that famous match in Karachi in the dark, of course, and won the series, the first time they ever won in Pakistan. Duncan, of course, went on then to help England win the Ashes for the first time for 18 years in 2005 in that epic series. Then he went on to coach India to a lot of success as well. So he's had a really superb coaching career. And you'd have thought maybe that he would still be coaching. But no, he's absolutely not doing any cricket coaching. This is what he has been doing over the last few weeks. And basically it involves bird watching in the Southern African bush.
Well, that's mainly why I tend to get too involved in things like I did with cricket. And now I've got into photographing birds more than wildlife, because an elephant's an elephant and a lion's a lion. But there's 975 birds in Southern Africa, and Southern Africa is from the Zambezi down. So it includes Zimbabwe, Botswana, Namibia, and half of Mozambique. And I've made it a mission. I'm never going to be able to do it, but I want to photograph all 975 birds. I've got to 760 at the moment, so in about 5 years. So I'm doing quite a lot of traveling with my wife, but sometimes I go on my own. And as I said to you, we went to an exciting adventure to Mozambique, into the bush. And I mean in the bush, we were driving where there were no roads, two buckies, as they call them, here, station. We call them buckies. I don't know what you would call them
in the UK.
Utes, are they? Utes, drive. Australia. Yeah, they've got to be four-wheel drive. And we went on this trip for 18 days, waking up at 4 o'clock every single morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and basically driving and looking for birds until it got dark. And we had a guy bitten by puff adder. He's lucky to be alive, because our nearest point of call to help him to get anti-serum was 4 hours. We got him there, and the doctors didn't know how to, two Mozambican doctors didn't know how to administer anti-venom, because you have to do it via drips. So they did it via YouTube. Can you believe it? These two doctors in the bush putting this serum in with via YouTube. They were fortunate the Wi-Fi was working, because if the Wi-Fi wasn't working, that bloke would have died. Well, he definitely would have lost an arm.
Amazing.
And then about 5 days later, we were sitting under some trees trying to photograph this very rare bird. Five of us sitting on our bums on the dirt when we suddenly heard a noise behind us. And we turned around and there were 8 wild dog. And if you know about wild dog, they're a very scary, scary animal. There were 8 of them behind us. One crept up testing us out. And the guide who was with us says, just stand up and look big. We stood up. I don't think they would have done anything with 8 wild dog, because they take down huge damn animals. And they played with us for about half an hour, and it was scary. I mean, I had one guy who was a doctor with me, and I mean, I was nervous, but I've never seen a human like that. He was scared. He was sweating. He was asking whether he should climb a tree. I said, I don't think you'll make it up the tree. So it was quite an adventure. So that's the kind of things we're going on at the moment.
God, it makes cricket sound a bit tame.
No,
it does. Going back?
It definitely does.
Are you going back for more? Are you going back for
more? I'm going back. I've been back twice since. Been back there as well. Well, we've just been the one place we were. The hunter, there was a hunter in the one Kutadi 11 where we went. He was bitten by a cobra and never made it. They flew him to Byra and he didn't make it with a cobra bite.
Big, doesn't it?
God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Blimey.
So it's exciting. They're adventures. It's really nice. Very, very nice.
Yours, it actually sounds terrifying, doesn't it? You think about some of the great fast bowlers that he might have faced during his career. You think of some of those sort of tight situations you're in as a coach. You know, you're watching your team, you know, all that tension. You're desperately trying to win. But imagine that, you know, snake bites, wild dogs, and it's all in pursuit of sort of fun as well, isn't it? Trying to take pictures of all these birds that are in
Africa. I would never have put Duncan Fletcher down as a bird watcher, I must admit. I've known him for 40 years, actually. I met him first in Zimbabwe when Middlesex toured Zimbabwe in 1980. And it sounds like a ridiculously long time ago now. And actually, they're hardcore, those Zimbabweans, because at the time, it was going through a process of independence, and that actually on that tour there were gorillas. There were gorillas hiding in the forests, sort of wanting to shoot people. And we had a bit of an escort as we travelled round Zimbabwe. But it was something that the cricketers, like Duncan, were kind of used to. They'd had it for years, and obviously after that, there was all sorts of controversies and people having their land seized, and it was a very difficult country to live in, and Duncan just sort of breezed through it. He was a very good cricketer, actually. He was an opening bat, a very sort of pugnacious batsman, left-hander, and also he opened the bowling as well. He was a feisty opening bowler, swung the ball, and a very good fielder. He was captain of Zimbabwe as well. So, he really was a fantastic all-round cricketer. So I could definitely see how he could become a coach. I couldn't quite see how he'd become a bird watcher. Right.
Well, we all know him as England coach. I mean, he's sort of imprinted on our memory because of what he did in 2005, how he was able to haul England up. Remember, he took over in the late 90s, into that tour of South Africa when England were at their lowest ebb, and he turned them around, and they won in Pakistan, the tour you mentioned, winning in Karachi. They won the Ashes. They had some lots of other successes on the way as well. A win in South Africa, for example, a win in the West Indies before the Ashes. And then it all went a bit downhill, didn't it? They lost in Pakistan. They didn't do particularly well in the 2007 World Cup, and it ended. But I mean, all in all, it was an extremely successful time for England under Duncan Fletcher. And obviously, I mean, I remember Duncan, there were Duncan days, what they used to call Duncan days in the media, is when England did badly, and rather than talk to a player, because there was no player to talk to that day because no one had done particularly well, Duncan was wheeled out. And so, we often were speaking to Duncan at when England had done badly, so it was sort of perceived that he was just a little bit down in the mouth, because I suppose he was always talking in difficult situations. They were what we came to know as Duncan days. But actually, the more he I don't think he liked doing the media either, did he? It wasn't his natural environment. even less natural environment than going into the southern bush and, you know, confronting all those dogs and snakes.
Well, some of those tabloid journalists are much worse than wild dogs, aren't they, actually? So, you know, in a way, he did have trouble sort of handling that sort of situation at times. I invited him into the virtual club quite partly because I obviously remember the impact he had, not only in that Ashes series of 2005, we will get on to that, but also in that iconic series in Pakistan when England won under Nasser Hussain. And so he's a man who people have often wondered what he did. You know, as often with successful coaches, you don't really ever find out quite what their secret is. But in Duncan's case, he did introduce, you know, one or two little ideas that players could either take on board or reject. And one of them, and this is why I sort of partly wanted to invite him in to talk about it, was the forward press before England went to Pakistan. It was all about how to play spin and to encourage players like Truscothick and Hussain and others, Atherton, to just take a little step forward before the spinner bowled. Because clearly in Pakistan, it could be a trial by spin, although they did have pace bowlers as well, but you would have long days in the field and long days with the bat where you'd have to face a lot of spin with men round the bat. So how would you combat it? He talks more about that in a moment. But first, I asked him how you actually go about winning in Pakistan.
I think you've got to have a lot of patience. A lot of patience. There's going to be times you're going to be tested off the field. And then on the field, you know, you're going to have to be very, very careful how you prepare for matches, because the wickets there generally are quite good batting wickets, but then every now and again you'll pitch up and there'll be a real turner. So you're going to probably have to practice playing spin and good spin bowlers, because they've always got magnificent bowlers who use the ball exceptionally well through the air, swing, reverse swing. So you're just going to have to make sure you prepare well and work damn hard off the field and get you sort of self mentally confident in what you're going to do.
There was that thing at the time that you encouraged players to adopt, which was the forward press for that tour of Pakistan, I think. Where did that come from, and what was the kind of strategy behind that?
Well, Simon, to me, I've said it all along. I mean, I think the coaching manual, there's been lots of things wrong in the coaching manual. And I remember my first speech as an English coach, I went up to meet all the coaches and I said a few things and you could just see the guys sort of laughed at me. But I think the coaching manual was wrong in many areas. And to me, one question I ask is if I said to someone, why do you move your feet? And no one can really give me an answer besides getting to the pitch of the ball. Well, I'm saying, why not stand with your feet apart and you're already at the pitch of the ball, so you can wait longer for the ball to come through the air and make a better decision to play the shot, and therefore just transfer weight rather than moving your foot. Because, I mean, I can go on for hours on this. Is if you've got a guy bowling at 100 miles an hour at you, and as soon as that ball leaves his hand, you've got to make a decision where you're going to pick up this foot, which is heavy, move your hips, which is the heaviest part of your body with your head, and put it in a position where it's going to land if he's on the front foot. Now, I'm saying, why not have your foot there already and just use your foot to create an angle as to where you want to drive the ball or play the forward defensive? I mean, it sounds simple, but I'd have to explain it to you on a chart, which I do. And that's what it's all about. And then just transfer weight. Hear a lot of people. I remember the great Peter Kirsten once, and he said to me they were going to play Alan Curry in a Western Province. This is when I moved down here and I went to a Western Province meeting before the season started. And they were worried about playing Alan Curry, this great spinner. And then they discussed something. And then on a TV interview, about two nights later, he was asked, how do you play spin? You're a good player of spin. And he says, I stand absolutely still until I find the length of the ball is, and then I move my feet, but I make sure I'm still. And he never did that. He didn't realize he actually pressed first. So he widened that stance. So that his last part is just a small movement, which is what you want. You know, you want small movements. As soon as you have large movements, error content is going to increase.
How easy was it to get that across to the players at the time? How did it take them a long time to be convinced, or did it sort of gradually filter in, or was there a sort of eureka moment when they, you know, so actually, no, this really works?
Some players, it's quite strange. You know, with some batsmen, you've sort of half finishing your sentence and they catch on. And some batsmen you can talk for 2 days and they still don't pick it up. And I don't know. You know, don't ask me the reason why, because I might get shot down, but I'll keep that to myself. But it's basically some pick it up quite quickly and some don't pick it up quickly. You know, they just don't understand it. You've just got to keep pushing it on. Don't push it too hard because they can start getting confused. You've got to be very clear in what you're saying. That, I must admit, you can't. You've got to give good reasons for it. You know, one of the things I find very strange in cricket is when a coach says, well, try that and see what happens. I mean, that's the most stupid statement I've ever heard. And the player should never accept that. You know, he should say, why should I do that? And you must have very good reasons. You know, like I've tried to explain why you stand with your feet apart. It's because why do you move your feet? Why not just transfer your weight? You're at the pitch of the ball, gives you more time to think about. Because remember, when that ball's coming at you, at 100 miles an hour and it swings, like say Malcolm Marshall used to, you had to make sure that you can, your foot's going out there when the ball's about 5 meters from his arm, once it's left his hand, 5 meters, I'm just using numbers, but I think you can pick up where I'm trying to lead to, is, and then suddenly you get your foot going in that line because it's a straight ball at that stage, you place your foot and then it swings, you can't pick your foot up again and then move it to where it swung to. So, but if my foot's out there, you can wait till the swing starts and then move it, then, because then you're in a better position to do that. But it's all to do with timing in that technique.
I know you kind of hide your light under a bushel a bit as coach, but going back to that 2005 series, what was the key to winning it, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's quite simple. There's two major factors, I think. We had talented cricketers. And like I've always said, it's quite sad to think that when you look back at that team, they were all under 30, and I thought he could really improve after 2005. Because I think there was only one player that was over 30, and I think that was Ashley Giles, if I remember right, because you are testing my memory tonight. But they were youngsters. They were really talented. We had an outstanding bowling attack. I mean, the king of all that and the tragedy he got injured is Simon Jones. I mean, I don't think people sort of look back and see what an important role he played, because the amount of fifers he got at certain stages, at critical stages, probably won us the series, his performances. And you had an outstanding captain in Michael Vaughan. I mean, he led the team really well from the front. And it was just those two factors. I think a lot of youth, a lot of enthusiasm. A lot of them weren't carrying baggage, because I played in some series where some baggage was carried and comments were passed and it used to get me down a little bit. But in this situation, everyone was fresh, up for it. They were really up for it. And by the end of the day, as I say, I think just they were talented cricketers, good batters, good bowlers, great fielders.
But you often see that with teams, you know, and obviously it's happening in the Football World Cup now as well. You see that with teams that they are talented, but they don't play to their talent. And so, you know, confidence and sort of self-belief are clearly kind of key ingredients. You know, as coach, you have to get that, to imbue that confidence in the players. You know, although you've got the talent, it's got to kind of somehow come out. So what was your secret, both for England and India, in drawing that talent out and getting that confidence, do you think?
I think it was just getting everyone to contribute. I mean, when I first joined England, I was very, very surprised at how teams were, I've got to be careful here, sort of managed in a way, in that there were seniors, juniors, newcomers, you know, and this sort of thing. And all my first thing I wanted to do was create a great team spirit off the field in the changing room. And I mean, there were things you had to do that. For example, I remember when I was at Glamorgan, for example, players used to say to me, please, I don't want to be 12th man for England. And I'd ask them why, and they would tell me what would happen. And I just couldn't believe this. And it was something that I thought, you know, even if you're 12th man, you're part of the squad. And I introduced things when we used to play the warm-up games. I used to make the 12th man captain of the side. If we were playing a bit of soccer, the 12th man would be captain and tell them to shout at Atherton or Hussein and make them part of the team. And by doing that, you just create a general team spirit that everyone's accepted in the side. There's no real seniors, no real juniors. Everyone's there to make a decision. And there were sort of committees I formed that were to make youngsters feel as though they were contributing. And that's the key. You've got to have a lot of leaders and contributing, helping the youngsters, and youngsters feeling as though they can contribute in strategy as well as performances on the field.
So we've heard a lot from Duncan Fletcher, England's successful coach, Ashes winning coach from 2005. Didn't Steve James write a book about Duncan Fletcher or the Duncan Fletcher years? And in it, he said, you know, Duncan's got a great sense of humour, and that probably, you know, never came out when he was England coach. He, you know, he was always quite guarded, wasn't he? I think in his media interviews. And actually, I mean, I interviewed him quite a lot, and I talked about Duncan days a bit earlier in the podcast. And in the early years, it was quite, you know, they were quite, they could be quite tense interviews, and Duncan wouldn't give you very much. But as time went on, as he became perhaps more successful, more relaxed, more used to the English media, his interviews started to get more and more interesting. And actually, in the end, we invited him onto Test Match Special, and he was a summariser for a while, and it was really fascinating to have him alongside us. Of course, and that ended up being nipped in the bud, I'm pretty sure, because he went to become coach of India then, and then, you know, time passed and things move on, and he did that job for till 2015. So, you know, he hasn't done it since. But, you know, you wouldn't naturally have thought Duncan as a Test Match Special summariser in the early days of being England coach, because he was quite clipped, quite guarded. You know, he didn't give a lot away. But I remember listening to him. There was a Test Match at the Oval, and it was ruined by rain on the last day, England India, when Duncan was coach, and he was on Test Match Special, and he talked for half an hour about fielding. And I wasn't working on that game. I was on holiday actually, but I was just listening to it. It's absolutely fascinating, just listening to him. Talk about some of the finer points of coaching, some of his theories on fielding, some of the drills that you do, so that, you know, if you could draw him out, there was a lot of really interesting, many interesting ideas that, you know, you can pick up on.
Yeah, you can hear his mind working, I think, a lot of the time. And he said a lovely thing to us actually in about 2002, 2003 during his tenure as England coach. At the end of a season, which we'd covered on Channel 4, he came to the production team, to Mark Nicholas and me and a couple of other people, and he just said, he made a special point of coming over to us. And even though I think England had levelled the series and hadn't won the series against India in 2002, he said, I just want to say thank you to all that you've done on Channel 4, because you've made the players feel better about themselves. Because I think we'd tried to create a tone of encouragement and intrigue and passion for the game, and, you know, tried to obviously delve into some of the finer points of the game as well, but often looked at a dismissal from the bowler's perspective. Instead of criticising the batsman for a bad shot, we'd say the bowler had worked out a clever way of getting him out, and often turning a negative into a positive. And so I think he understood that. He understood we were trying to sell the game, actually, and trying to sell the England team as well. And he really appreciated that, and the sort of detail that we went into in our coverage. So, you know, he was a man of detail in coaching. And clearly that helped England win that series in Pakistan in 2001. What about this one, though? It's a hard one to call, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, last time England were there, it was under Duncan Fletcher, actually, and they lost. It was straight after the Ashes. They went there and they lost 2-0. The first Test match, they were beaten by 22 runs, a game they probably should have won. They were only chasing just under 200 to win. They were bowled out for 175. Second test was drawn. Third test, they got absolutely pumped. They lost by an innings. They went down 2-0. So that was the last time England played a test series in Pakistan. So, what, 17 years later? One thing I've noticed, Yoz, is the series is being played, or obviously being played in December, 5.5-hour days. So with the way that the over rate goes these days, you know, we are going to get truncated days, aren't we? Pakistan pitches, generally speaking, are quite flat, slow and low generally, unless they decide to, you know, do something with them and inject a bit of life. The Australia series, it was quite attritional, wasn't it? In Australia, winning right at the end of the series. So my question, I suppose, is there going to be enough time in those conditions to force winning situations? And then if you can create a winning situation, are you going to be able to force them home?
Mm. Yeah, and certainly yours and my experience of being in Pakistan a while ago was that you are going to get short days. You're going to get missed in the mornings, in the winter in Pakistan, especially in somewhere like Islamabad or Multan. So you might have a delayed start, might have a bit of dew down on the ground as well, and it gets dark early. So you are going to have quite short days. The pitches won't do a lot. So it will be a bit of an attritional series, which the Australians handled very well, actually, didn't they, when they were out there? Mm. And they kind of just managed to engineer a couple of opportunities to win the game in the last test and sealed the series win. But it's a tough place to win. And, of course, you know, so much talent in Pakistan as well. I think they might just be a bit exposed on the bowling front, because Shaheen Shah Afridi, that brilliant left-armer, hasn't recovered from his injury in the World T20. So he's not there to spearhead the attack. And the other quicker bowlers are less experienced. So in a way, they haven't quite got the kind of the potency that they've had in many previous series with the ball. And actually, their spinners are not proven either. So Yasir Shah didn't make the side. So they haven't got that sort of experience to fall back on. So although obviously their batting is very strong, I'm not entirely convinced their bowling will be.
So that's England 150 all out then on the first morning of the first test match
in about 30 overs.
Well, if that. Oh, that's going to be one of the fascinating things, how England are going to play. Let's just have a quick look at that Pakistan squad that was announced. You talked about the pace bowlers. So the pace bowlers: Harris Rauf, Nasim Shah, Mohammad Wasim Jr. All three of those played in the T20 World Cup final. And then there's Muhammad Ali, who was the best fast bowler in the Pakistan first class season that is sort of drawing to a close at the moment. I think the final's being played at the moment, or it's about to be played. And he's been in really good form, 24 wickets this season and 56 wickets in the last two seasons. So those are their pace bowlers. And then spinners.
By the way, Harris Rauf has never played a test match. Mm. You know, he's obviously a brilliant one-day bowler, white ball bowler, but never played a test match. So, you know, that's going to be a voyage into the unknown if he gets picked.
Yeah, and then spinners, Noman Ali, Abrar Ahmed, a leg spinner who's, again, had a good domestic season, and he seems to have leapfrogged Yasir Shah, as you mentioned, Yasir Shah not playing, and then Zahid Mahmood as well, uncapped. He's played five white ball matches for Pakistan, and then there's Mohammad Nawaz, slow left arm, sort of all rounder, and you know, and that is their bowling attack. But as you mentioned, you know, they got the batting: Shaan Masood, Imal Haq, Abdullah Shafiq, Azhar Ali, Babar Azam, Mohammad Rizwan, you know, and one or two others as well. So yeah, that strength does look to be in the batting. They'll know the conditions though. They'll know what's required in Pakistan. And, you know, how are England going to play? What is England's approach going to be? Can you play in that ultra-aggressive way on slow, low pitches in Pakistan, if that is what we are going to get? What say
you? The evidence of England's warm-up match in the Emirates is certainly the case. So they smacked it around there pretty healthily, didn't they?
All the bowlers got 500. Whacked, didn't they, Yoz?
All the bowlers got whacked. I mean, yeah. the young new leg spinner, Rian Ahmed, went for 83 from eight overs. Livingstone was smacked everywhere. Not that I'm saying he's a frontline bowler, but I think Anderson went for 5 and over.
Yeah.
So clearly there's a purpose to the batting, which is going to be retained from the summer. Ollie Pope got a big 100. Zach Crawley got 90-odd. Mm. So I think they're going to be pretty positive. And, you know, it's not as easy in Pakistan because the bounce won't be quite as... I mean, I think they should probably all have slightly lower middles on their bats. And you can do that. You can move the middle of the bat down a bit, having a slightly fatter piece nearer the bottom of the bat if the ball is going to be a bit lower. That's what batsmen used to do that, you know. And if they, depending on where they were playing, they'd move the middle of the bat or get the bat manufacturer put a slightly higher middle or lower middle on the bat, depending on where they were playing. I think England are going to be pretty positive. I mean, there might just be times when they have to sit in, but I don't see anything other than them taking a fairly positive approach as they did in the summer because it worked so well.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the only problem I can see with that, and it, you know, it's going to be fun, fascinating to watch it, see where they can do it, is, I mean, I was thinking Pakistan, you know, in England, you get 300 quickly, or 320, that's not a bad score in England. If you get 300 in Pakistan, you know, then and you get them quickly, then there's time for the opposition to score 500, isn't there? I know that sounds, you know, of course there is, but what happens is the Pakistan or teams who go to Pakistan and are generally successful bat long, don't they? You get a big score over time, you wear the opposition down. That's sort of what happened in the Australia series. They're not quite wham bam conditions. So if you do happen to score at five and over but get bowled out from, you know, around 250, 300, you're not really in the game in the way that you are.
No, you're right. England, I mean, you definitely need to set your stall out to make 450 plus, generally, I think, in the first innings. Mm. So it will be about first innings. But in a way, another thing to think about that would encourage England to play positively is what we mentioned before, the short days, which means you're going to lose overs. Yeah. So if you want to get a result, you are going to have to be positive.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? Yeah, if you are really positive, you can take the clock out of it a little bit. But I suppose the challenge is going to be, in those conditions, taking wickets against Pakistan's decent batting lineup on flattish pitches.
Correct.
That seems to me the potential problem for England.
Yeah.
And are they going to be bowled out too cheaply for the conditions in too short a space of time? So that's what makes it an interesting series, I think. How England will adapt to playing in subcontinental conditions. Who do we think is going to play? Well, they're going to have to make two changes from the Oval Test match because they've dropped Alex Lees and Stuart Broad is not there. I noticed that Ben Duckett opened in the warm-up.
Stuart Broad,
match.
The new father, you mean, by the way?
Yeah.
I see Annabella Broad was born a couple of days ago. So congratulations to Stuart and Molly, his partner.
Yeah, well, I saw Stuart, actually. He doesn't live that far away from me, and I bumped into him outside a coffee shop, and he was saying, he said, it's due today. And this was a couple of weeks ago. This was before the T20 World Cup final. So he was sort of on tenterhooks, and Molly was in the car while he was getting his coffee. So that's great news to hear that she's been safely delivered. But yeah, he's missing this tour because of the birth of his new child. Anyway, so Stuart Broad's not going to be there, nor is Alex Lees. Duckett opened in the warm-up match, not Keaton Jennings. Jennings was in the middle order. And so what do England do with their bowling attack? Do they play a rookie leg spinner? Do they play someone like Liam Livingstone? I don't quite see how Liam Livingstone necessarily fits into the lineup. Do they play Will Jackson? What do they do? Do they play two spinners or a spinning all-rounder? It's not easy, is it?
It's very hard. Mm. You know, in the end, I mean, Nathan Lyon in that Australian series didn't take a lot of wickets, although he bowled quite a lot of overs. You know, the seamers, Pat Cummins, sort of finished the game off in that last test with a couple of wickets and reverse swing. I think they'll need pace if they can muster it. Hopefully Mark Wood will be okay. And they're obviously not going to have Jofra Archer, though, you know, he's made an encouraging return in that warm-up game in the Emirates. I think they're going to need some pace, though. I mean, Jimmy will obviously play, certainly the first test. And that maybe Ollie Robinson, those two. And then they need somebody who's going to reverse swing the ball, which, I mean, obviously Anderson is good at, but not at that great pace. I don't know. I don't see England's spinners having that much impact. Jack Leach will bowl and will bowl honestly. He probably won't take an awful lot of wickets. I can't see them playing Rehan Ahmed, really. I mean, he will be, if he plays, the youngest Test player that's ever played for England, is that right? I thought Brian Close was, actually.
I think he'll be a fractionally younger than Brian Close.
Brian Close, yeah. So 18 play. Years old, and he's only played 3 first-class games, so it'd be a massive risk, really, throwing him into a test match. But there's a lot of good talk about him, and he's obviously got a great attitude. He can bat as well, which is going to help him in his future pursuits.
He's already got a first-class 100, Yoz.
That's right. Yeah, amazing.
Batted five for Leicestershire against Derbyshire this summer.
Yeah. So the makeup of the attack is a funny one. It's going to be hard to figure it out. I mean, I guess obviously the pitch will have a bearing on that as well. The Roll Pindi pitch, who knows what you get? It's going to be pretty flat, isn't it? Probably. So you're just going to have to look at who you think are the... In a way, sometimes with selections for this sort of thing, you look at who's shaping up well in practice, who looks as if they've got rhythm, obviously within a general strategy, and it's kind of almost on the day, really.
Hmm. Well, I suppose the conundrum for England is, do they go with their 4 pace bowlers and a spinner and Joe Root, so 6 bowlers, or do they say, actually, no, we need to go 3 and 2? So, I mean, I'm talking about Ben Stokes being one of the seam bowlers. So Robinson, Anderson, Stokes, Broad was the attack, the pace bowling attack in the last test match of the summer. Do they change that because it's Pakistan? Do they bring in someone like, you know, Jax or Livingston or Rehan Ahmed to in place of Stuart Broad, or do they just say, actually, no, we're going to say bring in Mark Wood for Stuart Broad, and we look to go with a bit of pace and attack Pakistan with pace because we think that's our strength, even though it might be the conditions don't necessarily suit it. I noticed, actually, I was looking at some Rawalpindi results from the first class competition that's just been played in Pakistan. There were actually quite a lot of results. I noticed there was a game in Karachi where 600 played 480. Not necessarily looking forward to seeing a game like that. Generally speaking, it's better when the bowlers are involved. But yeah, there were a few results in Rawalpindi. So, you know, it might be there's something there in the surface, but is it going to be for pace? Is it going to be for spin? Is it going to be for a reverse swing? Or is it going to be, you know, quite flat and therefore in favour of the batting side? So there's a lot to look forward to, and they're often, yeah, it always is, isn't there, when England come up against Pakistan, the contrast and the styles of approach, and especially the style of an approach of this particular England side. It's going to be so interesting to see how they're going to continue after what they achieved in the summer, which I think, you know, wowed us all a bit, didn't it, the way they played in the summer.
Absolutely. It was really exciting, and, you know, credit to not only Stokes and McCullum for injecting that impetus, but to all the other players for taking it on and really getting stuck in. You know, they'll miss Bairstow, of course, who really injected some power and purpose into those run chases. In a way, Pakistan probably won't suit him quite as much because he likes the ball bouncing, so he can play his pull shot, and pulling in Pakistan is a little bit harder because it skids through a bit lower. So he won't perhaps have had quite as big an impact, but his general demeanour, his attitude, his aggressive, you know, belligerent method is such an extra ingredient. It takes a bit of the pressure off Stokes, actually. So they will definitely miss him. I do worry about England taking 20 wickets. That would be my major concern, getting that bowling attack right. Hopefully Mark Wood can get through, you know, at least one test and have an impact, because he's bowling absolute rockets at the moment, isn't he? Was in the World T20. And that's a major asset. The Pakistanis didn't enjoy his bowling in the T20 series in Pakistan before the World T20. He bounced a few of them out. So, you know, that's going to clearly be one strategy that England have, hoping that he's fit.
Yeah, absolutely, because he can be a point of difference, potentially. I notice England's record in Pakistan. I don't think I've mentioned this yet on the podcast. England's record in Pakistan, they played 30 test matches in Pakistan. They've won twice. The first match they played there in Lahore in 1961 under Ted Dexter, and then the famous Karachi win in the dark in December 2000. So 2 wins. Pakistan, how many wins for them? Only 4. And 18 draws, 18 of the 30 matches drawn. So there, you know, there's a bit of an indicator there, possibly. Pakistan, they are still alive in the World Test Championship as well. They've got 51% at the moment. England can't qualify. They're on 38%. Pakistan in fifth place. They need to get in the top two. So there's an incentive for Pakistan not just to win the series, actually to win some test matches if they want to qualify for the World Test Championship. I wonder whether that will influence their approach as well in terms of, you know, we say it might be attritional. Pakistan, have they got to force the issue? You've got two sides who want to force the issue. It could be fascinating. If you've got two sides who are going to sit in a bit and wait for the moment, as Australia did in that series earlier in the year, then it's going to be a bit more cat and mouse. Anyway, all gets underway on Thursday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'll be there with the Test Match Special Team. It's on Sky Sports as well. So, yeah, plenty to look forward to. So it's basically, Yoz, I know we said we're not mentioned football, but it's going to be cricket in the morning and then football from then on, isn't it?
Sounds perfect. Mm. Just no sleep then. Yeah. Having to get up at 5 o'clock to watch. Mind you, if some of the previous Pakistan-England series are anything to go by, might doze off during periods of that. Let's hope not. But you need to have some of your stories about food and travel are kind of at the ready, I suppose, if there are duller periods of play. But you're a master of that, so we'll look forward to listening to you. And thank you, everybody, for listening to us. We'll be back to review each day of this three-test series starting on Thursday.
Goodbye for now.
Podcast Network.